Stunned silence.
What is
this? We're doing the same, right?
So it must be doing something, right?
And it's playing,
Tell us what you're doing.
I just can't think of it.
I love the enthusiasm.
Sure.
You're tuned to the 15th Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 120 for October 2017. I'm your host, James, and then in the virtual rendition studios after some more technical challenges this week, we're always glad to welcome back Anna. How are you, Anna?
I'm well, thank you.
Good to talk to you. And also welcome back, because he wasn't here last time, the Don. How are you, Don?
Good, bro.
And it's always good to talk to Gavin. Gavin, how are you, mate?
I'm good, James. How are things on the other side of the Tasman?
They are quite good. Why, thank you for asking. They are quite
You've just
good.
Been gallivanting around all sorts of oceans and...
Well, I wouldn't say gallivanting.
Seas and...
But I was... I have just been travelling a little bit for work, yes. I was up in the States, up in New York, and it was a lot warmer than it is here. And also a little bit of time over in parts of Europe as well. So it's good to be home. Good to be back. How's everything over there in Australia, mate?
Yeah, pretty good. Summer arrived for a weekend a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
And now we're sort of back into spring, but it's very nice, very pleasant.
Very good.
Yeah.
And speaking of pleasant.
Long may spring continue.
Yeah. How's things with you, Anna?
Good, thank you. Busy, but looking forward to some warmer weather, actually.
Oh, yes.
If it ever happens.
If it ever happens, bring it on. That's right. And Don, all well with you? We haven't spoken to you for a while, mate. Last time we had a few technical challenges, you were all around the world.
Yeah. First time back in New Zealand for about 6 weeks, so pretty good to be back.
Well, it's good to have you all here, and we'll get straight into the news, starting off with some pretty sad stuff, but from the Catholic News Service. At an emotional interfaith prayer service at Guardian Angel Cathedral, Las Vegas Bishop Joseph A. Pepe told those filling the pews that in the face of tragedy, we need each other. Quote, and in the face of violence, we stand together because we cannot let hate and violence have the last word, he said in his remarks at the evening service. We gather from all faiths and walks of life. We pray and sing and listen to the word of God to remind ourselves that amidst this tragedy, God is with us, the bishop said. God cries with our tears. He quoted the evening scripture passage from chapter 29 of the book of Jeremiah. For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for well-being and not for calamity, in order to give you a future and hope. We come together in unity across our religious traditions, across race, across gender, to stand with each other as living signs of that hope, the bishop said. The service at the cathedral brought together people as they were still trying to fathom what had occurred barely 24 hours earlier. A crazy gunman, later identified by law enforcement officials as Stephen Craig Paddock, 64 years old, showered a crowd of about 22,000 attending a country music festival in a venue at the Las Vegas Strip the evening of October the 1st, showered the crowd with bullets, should be the quote. From his perch in a room high on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Casino Resort Hotel, he fired off hundreds of rounds of bullets down on the crowd below, ultimately leaving at least 59 people dead and more than 500 injured. It is the worst mass shooting in modern US history. Once police had located the shooter, SWAT teams burst into the room to find Paddock dead from self-inflicted gun wounds. I am struck by the signs of goodness even in the face of violence. I think about the first responders who risked their own lives to save the lives of others, the bishop said in his remarks at the cathedral. I think of the emergency medical personnel and hospital staff members who answered the call for well-being and a future by using for well-being and a future by using their skills to save lives. And I am reminded that many individuals who rendered aid, gave rides, and helped each other. They are the living reminders of the Good Samaritan and a God who calls us all from fear to care, he added. Pretty terrible news, everyone, wasn't it? This very, very sick man, terrorist man. I mean, this is the other thing. I did see a lot of commentary around, why wasn't there he being denounced as a terrorist just because of the colour of his skin? He shouldn't be sort of let off for what he was doing. But Gavin, what did you sort of make of all of this and what the bishop's remarks? I mean, at a pretty tragic time for America.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of, 120 episodes in, and every every few episodes we seem to have something of the, that's just so dreadful to talk about something like this. You know, Barcelona, not that long ago, you know, just a range of terror that seems to travel its way around the globe from time to time. And we can often think of ourselves as a bit sheltered from all of it and in our little corner of the world. But the nature of the modern media and television and just being able to witness some of the horror that took place, even from this distance, it's just hard to fathom. There's a church, actually, a Catholic church, not that far from where the concert was taking place, and it became a place where some people were fleeing for their safety. It's often spoken about in the reports that I read as a place where people go and seek a bit of refuge and peace from the sort of relative bling and just sort of the general frenetic nature of the Las Vegas Strip for those who have been there. But it became a different type of place for refuge and for peace for people, those in the sort of minutes and hours and in the days afterwards. And it became, I think, a bit of a staging ground for police to carry out some of their investigations and for emergency teams. It just a terrible thing, and for many people, probably in the US more than some other Western countries, there would be people who go and seek to find some sort of consolation amongst utter incomprehension by going to a church service, and hopefully there was some sense of support and healing for some of the people who were there to hear the bishop speak, and others, no doubt, all around Las Vegas and around the US last week or in the last couple of weeks.
It's something, Anna, I mean, it really does put things in perspective, but of course, it is one of those things where some of the other acts of terrorism that we have talked about on the podcast, and what it makes people do in terms of searching, trying to find answers in God. But this is probably, you know, this is a bit different in my mind. This isn't someone getting in a truck and sort of driving it into pedestrians, which is, you know, awful in and of itself. The level of premeditation and the, you know, all the details that have come out in terms of just the sheer amount of armaments that this crazy guy had really does take it to a next level, that there are people who are both, you know, very, very sick mentally, and then there are people who can actually really succumb to quite a bit of evil.
I guess, you know, many people who perhaps commit these kinds of atrocities, there's something in their lives that, you know, show when their lives are examined afterwards, perhaps, you know, they it's obvious that they're you know, something's not right with them. But I think what's quite scary is that, you know, they can't seem to find any particular reason for this man to have done what he did. And that's perhaps quite a scary thing, because he wasn't doing it for some kind of distorted idea of religion or, I don't know, like it was seemed like an utterly random thing to do. And perhaps even out of character, but maybe there's more to discover about his life in the aftermath. But I think that's sort of quite a scary thing to consider, that he did all that without perhaps any obvious kind of sign of you know, living a strange life or thinking strange things. Anyway, but it's a very sad event, and I just can't imagine how it must have been for those people when it all started happening, and not knowing where things were coming from and where the bullets were coming from and where to go. And
Well, I mean, Don, what would you say? I mean, I don't know if anyone's actually said this to you, but I mean, usually in these kind of moments of tragedy, and when you do see this kind of despicable, you know, terrible, horrible, you know, crime taking place, you will sometimes see some commentary in social media and others going, "See, look, this is proof that God doesn't exist, because why would he allow such evil in the world? if he was such a generous, benevolent God. And, you know, there's the quote from Jeremiah, for I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for well-being, not for calamity. But this is pretty calamitous. Do you start to sort of give them a bit of, if you run into those kind of people, do you talk to them about the dark side of free choice, free will?
No, but I guess I have run across those arguments on social media. I don't remember responding to those, but it does seem counterintuitive given what we know about theology and free will. And if someone really wants, I guess, to do something like that, and they're physically capable of doing it, God doesn't come down and stop them. He uses other people on earth, like policemen and ambulance officers and FBI agents and SWAT teams, to basically counteract these pure acts of evil. I guess we are his eyes, ears, and arms on earth.
It does strike. I mean, and we're not, you know, I was going to say, Gavin, we're not into politics on this podcast, but that wouldn't be entirely true. But I do think that there would be an element of, well, there's been plenty of discussion about Second Amendment rights and Americans and the sheer number of guns, being more guns in America than there are people, and, you know, all this sort of normal commentary. But even beyond those aspects of American culture in particular, having something like this happen in a tourism mecca like Las Vegas obviously makes everyone realize that you could be anywhere, anything could happen at any time. And I think the sense that you know, terrible things only happen in war-torn countries, I think that fallacy has long been dispelled by hacks like this.
Yeah, I was reflecting, and I feel like it was before these terrible events took place, but sometimes I think about how rare these things are in many ways. You know, you think about, say, for example, they had the Australian Rules Football Grand Final in Melbourne a couple of weeks ago. 100,000 people were there. And having been to games at the venue, you think, well, there's not actually really that much done to try and ensure the safety of people in terms of security checks. You know, there's sort of some arbitrary checks when you come in, but it's hard to be thankful that more things like this don't happen, because that seems counterintuitive. But in a sense, the opportunities for evil that exist that seemingly aren't taken, I guess is a way we could be thankful for that. And I was reading something over the last couple of days about a number of plots that have been thwarted by counterintelligence and those sorts of groups, and evil has always existed, it will always exist, and I guess that there are opportunities for the general public and for churches and other religious groups to try and continue to be a force for good and to try and change people and change their hearts. I'm not sure. Well, I'm not going to touch the Second Amendment discussion at this time.
We've done that path a few times before, but as with any of these tragedies, it is a good opportunity to realize that these things do happen, that the world is darkness and light, and that you know, if we take the best possible situation here, it's a need for making sure that those that have mental health issues have the support and care that they need. And if we take the other end of this, that we need God's intervention, because without it, we are left to some individuals totally abusing the gift that God has given us of free will. And I'm not going to try and segue into this next one, but this is from the National Catholic Reporter. Pope Francis has admitted that the Catholic Church waited too long before taking reports of clergy sexual abuse seriously, suggesting that the former practice of moving priests accused of abuse to new ministries instead of reporting them to authorities kept the church numb to the scope of the situation. In its first formal meeting on the 21st of September with the now three-year-old Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors, the pontiff also called prophetic the men and women who urged the church for decades to face the problem. "I know it has not been easy to start this work," the Pope told the members of the commission in the off-the-cuff remarks notable for their frankness. "You have had to swim against the current because there is a reality. The church has taken consciousness about these crimes in a delayed manner." "When the consciousness is delayed, the means for resolving the problem are delayed," said Francis. "I am aware of this difficulty, but it is a reality. I'll say it so. We have come to this late. Maybe the old practice of moving people around, of not facing the problem, kept our consciousness asleep," the Pope suggested. "Thanks to God, the Lord sent prophetic men and women in the church who got others involved and began this work to face the problem head on." Francis told the members of the Pontifical Commission that while the speech he had prepared for their meeting was important, they had a right to hear from him spontaneously in order to learn how things have come and how they are going with the church's response to clergy sexual abuse. The commission is meeting in Rome this week for a plenary assembly. While Francis greeted some of the group's members at their first meeting in May 2014, he had never before formally met with them or offered public remarks about their work. The Pope's words come as the group has recently faced public questioning of its effectiveness in stopping future abuse of children in the Catholic Church. It is currently operating without any active members who are abuse survivors, following the March 1st resignation of Marie Collins, who cited frustration with the Vatican officials' reluctance to cooperate with the group's work. That last bit, Anna, gets my blood pressure up. The citing Vatican officials' reluctance to cooperate with the group's work. How on earth could they possibly... I'm not going to ask you to tell me how they could justify that. What did you make of the Pope's remarks? Off the cuff, quite frank, quite direct. What did you think?
You know, at first, the first thought that came to my head was like, well, that's a no-brainer, Pope Francis. Like, yes, we were slow. But then I thought, you know what? Actually, we have to be perpetually reminded of it. I just actually sort of in the last couple of months have become a little bit more interested, just interested in the whole sexual abuse problem in the church, and really, yeah, like we have to keep it in front of us that we made so many mistakes and so many people have suffered because of it. And I don't think it's a bad thing that we keep reminding ourselves, because the worst thing would be is to sort of get complacent again. Oh, we've put, you know, we've all the dioceses have got these different things in place and the Vatican has done this and that, and you sort of pat ourselves on the back and sort of say, oh, you know, it's fine now. I think the thing is that we've got a long way to go before we can get anywhere near saying it's fine, because there are still many, many people suffering because of it. Even if we have no more new cases, there's still, you know, there's still suffering. There's a loss of faith. There's just so much problems still. And that the commission is struggling with some members in the Vatican is not great news to hear, is it?
It really isn't, and it's one of those things where you just wonder. I mean, Don, could the Pope be taking a stronger position on clergy sexual abuse investigations? I mean, identifying that, you know, some people have resigned and things like that. Why is this the first time, you know, since 2014 that he's actually formally met with them? I mean, why hasn't he got, you know, almost weekly meetings with them, sort of saying how this problem is being addressed?
Yeah, I agree. I didn't even realise that it was a current issue. My understanding was that it was something historical and in our past, and that people were in their own deluded ways trying to protect the church by protecting it from scandal, but eventually when it came out, it did far worse. But my understanding is that we had some of the best processes and procedures in the world, But this latest article maybe seems to suggest otherwise. Mm. So we have to be vigilant, and we have to be at the forefront of these types of processes to both identify and root these cases out of the church. And I'm not a fan of the media, because it seems that they seem to pick on the church whenever these cases do arise. And certainly my understanding is that our rates are either the same or lower than that of the general population, but we can always strive for better. But having said that, I don't think it's still a human church, and we can never root it out 100%.
Gavin, what did you make of the Pope's remarks on this?
I probably share the view that you sort of read them initially and you think, well, yes, clearly things happen far too slowly, as they did in all parts of society in responding to this. And just in the last few days, we were seeing another institution, sort of, if we can call Hollywood an institution. I suspect that the current information that's coming out, and granted some of this is the stuff with Harvey Weinstein and others, is certainly typically with adults, but certainly an abuse of power and an abuse of privilege, in much the way that a lot of the clerical abuse was. So this terrible evil exists in lots and lots of places. Some of the other comments that the Pope Francis made, particularly around the idea of ensuring that there's greater incentive or greater initiative to laicize priests who have been found to have abused children, I think is hugely important. To me, that should be a mandatory step, essentially, if a priest is proved, particularly one who is has admitted that he engaged in this terrible sort of sexual abuse of minors, and that they be laicized. I didn't read comments in there that referred specifically to the role of bishops and how they might be treated if they've been found to have been negligent or worse in their duties. I think, again, that people need to see that the church actually has taken seriously some of the recommendations that have come before it. And I think that means that those who have failed in their leadership or in their own commission of some of these crimes, there should be a sign to the church that, you know, that this is truly unacceptable. And while they can remain members of the church and people who are open to forgiveness, they are people for whom the ongoing office of priest or bishop, or heaven forbid, even cardinal, they are no longer people who are worthy to hold those positions. So I think it was important to see those comments. And he did admit that previously he had erred on the side of mercy and compassion to a priest, and that priest who had been recommended to be laicized wasn't, and he later offended again. So Pope Francis acknowledged that he probably didn't know enough about this, which is concerning in and of itself, as after being the Archbishop of a large diocese for many years. But I think there are some positive signs amongst all that's been said. Mindful that I think there does need to be some work to get representation from abuse survivors on this commission. I think there's a bit of conjecture over the departure of Ms. Collins and how that came about, but I think it's important that the voices of those who have suffered the most are heard at the highest levels.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's one of those things where, for me, you know, as we've talked about on this podcast, a depressingly large number of times about this the crisis, and we will continue to do so, because it is something that I don't think will ever be removed until it can be removed from the population as being something that happens. But absolutely, the church should be as close to zero as possible in terms of new cases. We should be putting every possible safety and control in place to actually say it doesn't happen inside of the church. Some of the remarks from the Pope, as I was sort of reading through them, going, yeah, but surely there is nothing more serious on the agenda for the church than continuing to do whatever is possible to address the hurts of the past and to ensure it never happens again. I'm sort of a bit staggered about that he hasn't formally met with them since 2014. So that I found quite surprising. And in terms of the membership of the Pontifical Commission itself. But yeah, as we've talked about on the podcast before, I mean, if you're listening to our first episode, you've come in with some pretty heavy topics for us to start with. But as you can go back through our previous episodes and hear our positions on this. But mine are quite clear. You know, any priest who has been accused and found guilty of this kind of terrible, abhorrent crime, absolutely, it should be laicized immediately. Mercy is fine. Like, you know, if they beg forgiveness, then I'm sure God will forgive them of their sins. But that does not mean that they continue as a priest. And the big issue, as we've talked about before, of bishops moving priests around, which and it would be a massive benefit of the doubt. But in the early days, the advice they were given around the fixation being with a child, and so if you move the priest away from the child, then you know you were doing the right thing for the child. But the first time that someone did that and then that priest reoffended, then that should have been the end of that policy. That should be the end of that practice. Oh, it's just so frustrating. It's frustrating. So, you know, Pope Francis, I know you're a frequent listener to the 15th Station, Holy Father. Just, you know, if you need any tips from us or any advice from us, you cannot go too tough or too hard on solving this problem, would be my opinion. I think so. Yes, that's good. I'm sure the Oceanic bishops would agree with me. They've called for something a little bit different. This is from NZ Catholic. Oceania's Catholic bishops have called on their respective governments and civic authorities, quote, to be vigilant in guarding against any attempts by international businesses to exploit our common resource, meaning the oceans. The Executive Committee of the Federation of Catholic Bishops' Conferences of Oceania, that's Australia, Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, New Zealand, CEPAC, and the rest of the Pacific, met in Auckland from August the 7th to the 12th. The executive committee members able to attend were from Port Moresby, Toowoomba. There's archbishops from Noumea, our own Dunedin and Palmerston North bishops, and also from Parramatta in Australia. See how I deftly avoided trying to say their names?
Yeah, well done.
As bishops of the Pacific, the place of the sea and the lives of the peoples we serve was a central focus of our meeting. Our common ocean is teeming with life and goodness. For many of our peoples, the sea is their treasured source of nutrition, sustenance, and livelihood, they said in a statement released after the meeting. Our interest in the, quote, blue economy is to uphold a model of development that respects the fundamental importance of sustainability, that looks way beyond any perceived short-term economic windfall, the statement added. Bishop Drennan said the plight of Kiwi lay missionary Doug Tennant, who was deported from Papua New Guinea in June, was also discussed in the meeting. He, Mr. Tennant, was a much-respected advocate for justice in Papua New Guinea and taught law at university level in that country, Bishop Drennan told NZ Catholic. Happily, we can say that due to various interventions, he has now been allowed to return to the nation he loves and serves. But this whole incident reminds us of the ugly collusion that sometimes exists between corrupt officials and unscrupulous business interests, he said. The bishop also expressed concern for the livelihood and cultural integrity of the people of West Papua without going into the issue of independence. Don, what did you make of the bishops talking about the... I'd never heard of the blue economy before. I mean, it makes sense when you think about, particularly in the Pacific, how much, especially a number of the smaller Pacific islands, rely on the ocean for everything about their livelihood and sustenance. But what did you make of the bishops' statement there?
I think it's good in principle, but yeah, as with anything, the policy really comes down to the details. And it's really trying to balance short-term and long-term and the need for the economies to get some cash flow and for individuals to get some cash flow in the short term and to drive development in the short term without sacrificing the future, so to speak. And it's a difficult task because who knows what technology we're going to have in the future to clean up stuff. But I guess my main word of caution would be
There's a lot of development groups around the Pacific who overly romanticize small businesses and slow development. I would just caution that they balance those off with some larger scale projects, perhaps from multinationals, but do so at a kind of incremental pace, which the infrastructure of those economies can keep pace with.
I forgot Don was our resident Pacific correspondent, because Don, for those who don't know, Don actually spends a lot of time, or has spent a lot of time travelling through there and in his professional life, and understands the Pacific economy certainly a lot better than I do. So,
so we'll have Don. And my thesis was in tourism in Samoa and development studies.
There you go.
Well, that's totally why I went to Don first. It wasn't just because it was his turn. I went to Don first, and also not because I thought he'd have an opinion on matters relating to the blue economy. But it's fascinating, Don, when you know the complexities that are associated. I mean, these so many of these communities rely dependent. You know, they're part of a much broader ecosystem. But that ecosystem isn't just ecology, right? It's also economy. It's a connection to other countries like ourselves, like Australia and New Zealand. So I guess what you're saying is that, as you said at the start, it's sort of good in principle around making sure that we're not overly stuffing up the oceans, but it's complicated in its implementation.
Yeah, and it's all in the detail, and I guess we have to be wary of some of the ideologies of some of the development officials. Especially some of the kind of UN type things that do have quite anti-Catholic policies in terms of their approach to contraception and abortion. So again, there's a moral element which we really need to fight against as Catholics.
Gavin, what did you make of the bishop's statement there after their conference?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was sort of a bit new to the whole idea of the blue economy as well. I certainly heard of the green economy, and there are probably a few other coloured economies as well that I haven't yet heard of. But certainly we know that. Also, we think about the ocean and some Pacific nations' relationship with the ocean as it continues to creep up on them and potentially threatens their future. So that's obviously one of the sort of the considerations that would probably be part of their thinking as well, as how you can continue to protect that resource as in the oceans, but also trying to ensure that it doesn't become something that overwhelms places like Kiribati and other countries and parts of the Pacific that are struggling. We haven't actually covered the story that they alluded to there about the Kiwi missionary who was forced out of Papua New Guinea a few months ago. So there's sort of a lot of murky details around how it all happened, but I think it's interesting that the comments that were made about that, but in terms of the corruption that exists in a lot of cultures, and we shouldn't suggest that corruption only exists in certain parts of the world. Obviously, it exists everywhere. But just seeing how people can work to stifle the efforts of an individual missionary or a church more generally, and trying to be a force for good, but the way that certain people can look at that and say that, well, you know, if you're particularly, and I'm not sort of referring specifically to this case because I don't know all the details of Mr. Tennant, but you could imagine someone who has strong understanding of Catholic social teaching around a range of things like a fair wage or unionized workforces, going to places where workers are not treated fairly and justly by businesses, large or small, that they might come in and say, oh, hey, that's not how you're supposed to treat people. That's not dignity of workers and dignity of human people. People sort of join forces to have a person no longer be in Papua New Guinea to be able to make that case. So it's just interesting to see how individuals or the church's message, it's often unpopular, and sometimes people go to significant lengths to try and make sure that it's suppressed and not heard. But as it's turned out, he's been able to go back and continue his what apparently was pretty marvellous work over there.
It's something where I'm just, sorry, I was just reading as you were saying there in terms of the work of Doug Tennant. Yeah, you're right, we haven't covered that before, have we? No.
No, it's been a story that sort of floated around, and we haven't always found it easy to, well, I haven't, and preparing the show notes, haven't always found it easy to say, well, here's a story and here are the facts, and we can have a robust discussion about it, because yeah, sometimes the facts haven't been quite so easy to
get them together. Anna, what did you think? I mean, it's good points that Gavin raises, not just about the oceans being you know, the sustenance point, but actually also being something which can, you know, with global temperatures rising and sea levels rising and the threat to some of these smaller nations, is obviously something which is a, you know, it's a big concern. So it's probably good that bishops did have some commentary on it.
Absolutely. I guess to have a good way forward to, you know, look after the resources you have and use them wisely for people who are around now and also for the future. What that takes is, I guess, yeah, good business practices and government officials who are have good judgment and not there for their own interests or lining their own pockets. And so, yes, the church must sort of speak up about those things, and not be silent about it. And obviously those, you know, those bishops are seeing that in their own backyards, in their own countries. And so it's important. Yeah, I'm glad to hear them speaking about it and perhaps bringing to light, I guess, corruption and things like that, if it's not, I guess it thrives on, you know, being under the radar or, you know, people being afraid to speak about it. But, you know, if you bring it out into the light, then perhaps it's not as scary as what it is and what it seems to be, and can be, you know, worked on to be resolved, you know, for the benefit of everyone.
Which I think is the point the bishop's trying to raise, right? They're about doing some of these things and making these kind of announcements and statements. The idea is to try and draw attention. You know, if Gavin or myself were to make some sort of announcement, it probably wouldn't get covered in the press. Maybe the Institute Catholic would, maybe Gavin. Maybe they would listen to some of the stuff you'd say.
Depends what the announcement is.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. But what if you're announcing that social media is an important tool for evangelization? Would that get picked
up? I'd report that.
This is from the Catholic News Agency. Between Harambe memes and quick explanations of Catholic doctrine on his Twitter page, Bishop Richard Umbers, an auxiliary bishop of the Archdiocese of Sydney, says that online humour is about more than just the laughs. More than just the lols is what they should have said. In fact, he says Christian humour...
LOLZ.
LOLZ. Christian humour online can help to reach out to parts of our modern world that are in the process of secularisation. This kind of online engagement, with a wink, plays into a larger need for Christians to engage in society and to promote a vision of Christian life. Umbers is quick to note in his Twitter bio that he is indeed an actual person and a real bishop, adopting the description given to him by Tommy Teague, the Catholic hipster. Whether in art, online culture, or political discussion, Christians should be giving an example of how to evangelize and to speak to the challenges society faces today. You need the contemporary expression of Christian faith, Umbers said, of what the church needs from its faithful today. Umbers was born and raised in New Zealand. Yes, good man. After guidance from a mentor, he discerned a call to the priesthood, upon which he travelled to Rome and then to Spain to continue his studies. He was ordained a priest of the prelature in Spain in 2002. 14 years later, Umbers was consecrated a bishop, becoming in 2016 the youngest bishop in Australia at the age of 45. Part of the reason he's drawn to memes, Umbers said, is not only because they match his sense of humour, but because of his own limitations. I have an artistic vision with zero talent, he joked. More seriously, memes do indeed convey a message. Like political cartoons, which have spread powerful ideas and opinions for centuries, memes can also convey earnest information. Honesty and consideration can add balance to online evangelization. I tell people all the time, be yourself, Umbers said. He also advocated that Catholics Online display their convictions and even make strong comments, but advise them to consider what they say before they type. The bishop also urged that Catholics Online have faith and conviction in their beliefs, especially if they dabble in memes or in online discussions. It takes a certain confidence in your faith, he said, of online participation and discussion. This confidence can even help bring out the humour of the whole situation. Who would have thought, Gavin, that social media, this new media, is a tool for evangelisation?
Who would have known? Who would have thought it? I was reflecting recently, actually, on you, James, the man who changed my view of social media, or actually made me understand what social media was to a large extent, and got us involved in Being Frank, the blog that you made me set up, that we set up together, and then this, which is, 15 Station is really a little tool for a slice of evangelization amongst a group of friends sitting around and having a bit of a chat about some of the big Catholic stories of the last few weeks. So clearly we think that the bishop's onto something here. Now, I'm not great at memes either. I don't even have the artistic mind and no talent. I just have the no talent part. But, one of a good friend of Anna's and a friend of mine, he's someone who likes to delve into this as well. He's a theologian, and he seeks to get involved in some of these online memes. And he ran into some trouble the other day after posting one that he thought was quite funny with Martin Luther as we get ready for the 500th anniversary of his little intervention at Wittenberg later this month. But so they can be a source of hilarity and lols, but they can also be a source for a bit of tension. But as long as we've got, I think, an open mind and a sense of charity in our engagement online, and maybe try and treat it as we would a discussion with someone face to face, rather than, hey, I don't know who this person is, so I'll treat them with complete disdain in a way that I wouldn't someone face to face. Social media is a great opportunity for us to engage with friends and foes alike, and some important discussions, not just cat videos.
Cat memes. Yeah, no, I think it's good, Anna, to hear a bishop sort of pointing this out, that these are tools for evangelization, particularly in a world that is becoming increasingly secularized. We've got to meet people where they are.
Sure, and lots of people are on social media, and so that's, yes, where they are. I might need some convincing that I guess when I see on Facebook and other forms of social media and things that, like, what I actually see out there is, I don't think really, like, I don't see much fruit of people, like, really connecting with what perhaps is posted. I see a lot of people just arguing over what is posted, and I'm probably one that still needs a bit more convincing the fruitfulness of I'm sure it's possible, but just a lot of what I see, someone puts up something that is sharing about their faith or something like that, and far out, what might be in the comments section is, it just ends up being just message after message after message of trolling or people responding to that. And perhaps I have a bit more of a negative view on it, but I think it has potential, and it is, I think, the place where that needs to be. Is it actually a place that, like, social media and online stuff, and it needs to be purified, I think, and reformed, and because some of it does get out of hand, right? Like, not even just talking about religious stuff, but just in general, and perhaps that's something that the church could do, but yeah.
It's definitely something.
It could.
Oh, actually, I should let Don defend. Don, you can defend social media. What do you reckon? Has Anna got a point, or is she way off base? Is the bishop right?
Sorry, I'm going to agree with Anna.
Oh.
On you go. Go on. So
did you say agree with me, Don?
Yeah.
Oh.
So there's been some research in terms of so that they researched a whole bunch of millennials as to why they've left the church. And basically, only 8% of them left the church because they thought it was outdated. And overwhelmingly, they left the church because they didn't think that they were getting an authentic experience. If you can try to compete with social media and compete with cool and compete with, you know, cat videos and things that are interesting, you're just not going to win on the Jesus front. So my solution to this, and it's not even my solution, it's the Bishop of Lincoln, Nebraska's solution, or three very good successive bishops, from a population of something like 100,000 Catholics, every year they're looking at 49 seminarians. So they're kind of the amazing stats that are coming out from Nebraska. But what have they done very well? They've taught a very authentic Catholic experience. They've been fairly orthodox. They haven't tried to be cool. They have, and if you try to be cool, you're just not going to compete with the radio or television. So,
or Cornhuskers football in Nebraska.
Or the Yankees. You're just not going to compete on the entertainment front. So why try? What are we good at? And it's basically teaching the message of Jesus, an authentic message of Jesus, and the Eucharist. So if we teach those things well and go back to the roots of Catholicism, and take the blueprint from Lincoln, Nebraska, I think that's our key to the salvation of the church and reversing the decline in our church. And until the bishop, it all starts with bishops. And if you look at the case of Lincoln Nebraska, it came three bishops ago and two very good bishops after that.
Not many times do we speak so much about Lincoln, Nebraska. I've been in Lincoln, Nebraska. It's a fine town, can I say. But I think to your point, Don, I'm not disagreeing with the general tenet of the importance of authentic teaching and the centrality of the Eucharist. But I think the former, at least, can be something that social media assists with in terms of being supportive of the transmission of authentic teaching. Now, we still haven't quite figured out how to distribute the Eucharist via social media. I think we can, there are people who are doing it well, using social media to disseminate authentic teaching. I think we should support that where we can.
Absolutely. And, well, I think you make the main point there, which is that the social media is not a strategy in itself. The main strategy needs to be, in my opinion, a return to orthodoxy and a return to authenticity, Catholic authenticity, and not trying to be cool with secularism. And social media should play a role in supporting that, but it's not the main strategy.
No, and I think. Yeah, I don't think the bishop's saying it's the main strategy. I think it's a good point. I'll take the bishop's side, which actually isn't that too hard for me to do in this situation. surprisingly. I definitely, and I'm not contesting at all the point around the authentic nature of, that the focus should be on the Eucharist and the authentic nature of the message of Christ. Absolutely, Don, totally agree with that. And I also couldn't agree more that you never read the comment section. That is just, people do not heed the good bishop's advice in terms of, you know, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything. Well, actually, that's not the bishop's advice, it's my mother's advice. If you can't say anything nice about someone, don't say anything at all. But treating it like the person is there. I was actually reading another article in the NZ Catholic talking about the need to just, people need to just chill a little bit on Twitter. That wasn't what the headline was. But that people were trying to engage in, some were arguing that they're engaging in filial correction of doctrinal errors by the Pope, and others were just basically turning into a massive ad hominem sort of attack and just doing it in 140 characters. But I do think that, specifically talking about memes, I think that as we have moved, whether we like it or not, I'll put my hand up for not really, but whether we like it or not, we've moved it into this scroll down, infinite scroll, swipe left, swipe right, you know, like, up, down kind of world of people staring at blanks, but at glass, and just sort of scrolling through how they engage with friends, how they engage with colleagues, how they engage with family. And if we're not there at all, there's no opportunity to even start to teach at an authentic level. And I mean, if you look at the Bishop's Facebook page and you look at his Twitter account, it's not just meme. It's a whole bunch of and you know, celebrated Holy Mass with Father Greg Morgan as my server at St. Francis of Assisi, Notting Hill. We prayed for Her Majesty during the Lenten 9 prayers. And then right below that, you know, a dank memes retweet. I mean, so, you know, he's interspersing the two. And that's the thing which I think is a good idea, because people scroll through and the research also shows that they'll see pictures more than they'll see the words. And when the picture has a sense of humor to it, humor seems to cut through a number of boundaries, a number of barriers that people put up. And I just think that every photo I see of Bishop Umbers has him with a big smile on his face. So I think using humor in that regard to try and engage with people, to then start talking about... using it as a platform to then start to have conversations about the faith, I think is a good idea.
Agreed.
Good. There we go. Okay. Last word.
Solved it.
I mean, I think what we'd all agree is you need to go to, it's a good idea to get off Facebook and go to Mass more. And everyone's been listening to that. Even famous musicians. This is from Alatisha. Is that how you say it? Is it Alatisha?
Ask the Italian speaker.
Let's imagine the scene. Okay, everyone, here you go. Imagine the scene. You're at Mass in your home parish, and right behind you, praying in silence, is a famous celebrity. You are astonished, especially when that famous person rises and stands next to you in line for communion. This is what it felt like for the parishioners at noon Mass at the modern gymnasium in Bogota. There, they were suddenly met the vocalist of the historic band U2, who took a break in his busy day of touring in Colombia to attend a local parish Mass and receive the Holy Eucharist. According to those attending Mass, Bono arrived alone. He stayed quietly in the back of the room, prayed in silence, and received communion. He was just one parishioner who attended the Sunday Eucharist. The Eucharist ended and Bono left as he arrived, making no noise and with the apparent sole intention of feeling the presence of God. It's a surprise to meet someone famous at Mass. In Bono's case, the surprise may be more that he was in Bogota, Colombia, but not that he was at Mass. He himself has on numerous occasions given testimony of faith. So there you go. Bono's Catholic. It's like, oh, well, the Pope's Catholic. I mean, we already knew that. I'm like on this article, you know, there's a photo taken of him actually receiving communion, and I'm kind of like, that's obviously been taken by someone at Mass. It looks like on the altar. Like, looking down, and it's like, maybe you should be focusing more on, you could have just said Bono was there rather than taking a photo of the guy at quite an intimate moment.
No one would have believed him.
Yeah,
well, take a photo of him sitting in the pew then, rather than actually at the point of receiving communion. But did anyone else think is this news to anyone that Bono's a practicing Catholic?
No, it's not news.
Still
no, but it's cool.
It is cool.
I would find it pretty cool. I just wonder if there's no mention of him joining in the hymns. Maybe they just didn't have a choir or something. But, you know, you could have got him doing a bit of, you know, a bit of Matt Maher or some...
Come to the Water?
You know, Marty Hogan or something. you know, some really high-quality music. Hashtag sarcasm. But, yeah. I mentioned that he was saying his prayers, but was he joining in the hymns?
Well, that's a good
point. Maybe his Spanish isn't great.
That's a good point, maybe. Have you ever seen any celebrities at Mass, Anna?
I have, actually.
Ooh!
I attended Mass with Pierce Brosnan.
Stop once. It.
What?
Yeah. At the Melbourne Cathedral. I'd been up to communion and I was sitting in my seat and praying my prayers, and I just looked up, and so he was sitting at the back as well, so he was must have been quite far behind me, but so yeah, Pierce Brosnan was walking past. He'd been up to communion, and it was very exciting. I forgot to say the rest of my prayers, to be fair. But,
bit like that, was it?
Don.
But starstruck.
Don, what about you, mate? Have you ever seen a celebrity at church? No, you can't say Jesus.
Oh yeah. He's the protagonist in the best-selling book in the world.
Okay. Other than Christ, obviously, I cut you off. I knew you were going to go there with it. See, I even said at the start, other than
you cut me off.
I spoiled your punchline. That's right. Yeah. But anyone else? Anyone else far less significant?
No. I saw Emma Stone a couple of weeks ago, but that was like,
not a mess.
Not a mess, though.
Not a mess, no.
What about TVNZ celebrity Tim Wilson?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I've seen him.
Yes, I have seen him.
Yeah.
There you go.
With young Rebecca or Rachel?
Celebrity yes, watching. Rachel. I mean, the reality is for me that I'm so absorbed in my prayers that I've never really paid any attention to any celebrities that I've seen.
Oh, you would have probably seen... former TVNZ newsreader Philip Sherry at Mass.
James,
I suspect.
Yeah, years ago. Yeah, you're right. That's a good point. Well, Gavin, what about you?
They're not Bono level.
No.
International sense, but, you know, world famous in New Zealand.
I remember going to a Mass in a cathedral here, and there was I think it was the Swedish royal family or the Norwegian royal family, and they had the security guards and all the rest of it as well. So, yeah, no, it's good. It's good.
It's pretty good.
If you want to try and sort of go on a celebrity hunt through our previous episodes, you can go find them at www.station15.co.nz. You can, of course, always subscribe for free on iTunes and Google Play and where all good podcasts are found. And if you want to reach out to us, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email to podcast@station15.co.nz, or is it feedback@station15.co.nz? It's only been in the last, 10 or 15 episodes that I've got myself a bit confused on the email address. You can send it to either one. We'll get it. podcast@station15.co.nz. We are on that new tool of evangelization, the internets, and you can find us at twitter.com/station15 or facebook.com/station15. Thank you so much, Anna, for making your time. It's always good to talk to you.
No worries, James. Good to be here.
And Don, welcome back. Always good to have a chat to you, mate.
Likewise.
It's great to bring in your expertise on the blue economy in particular. I knew you had that. That's why I was asking you. And Gavin, it wouldn't be the 15th station without you, mate. Thank you very much for once again getting us all together.
Thank you, James. No show without punch, isn't it?
That's true. Very true. So I guess we'll punch again next month. And until then, take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.